You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Good afternoon, folks. This is Columbia Calling, and I am your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota with you alone this time again for 45 minutes, talking about Columbia, issues that affect Columbia, the nuances of this very interesting country, which I now call home. So we're here, 2,600 meters, close to the stars. And, well, yes, I hope you enjoyed last week's show with Francesca Tarrant. Now, that was very fun to have someone so erudite and informed on the show. So, Francesca, talking about Armero, talking about Hacienda Nápoles, talking about work, talking about the cultural and classes system here in Colombia. Yeah, I found it fun to be doing that show. I do have further interviews in the pipeline, but as you know, these things take time to cement, and we're being in Colombia at times. Sometimes these things aren't so free and forthcoming. So we're lining up people. I hope to have some people to talk about transitional justice, given that everything that's happening at the moment in Colombia, especially with the peace dialogues. Also, as this year is the 30th anniversary of the Armero disaster, I would like to also get some survivors on the show. I have contacted some people who are interested. It's just now about finding a mutually convenient time. Thankfully, the tourism fair is long behind us now, and we can look forward to Semana Santa, which is almost upon us. So we've got a couple of weeks' work before Semana Santa. Can I say a couple of weeks? It's now 16th of March. And so, yeah, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th of April. Mompos, my little Mompos, will be crowded with people. Popayan, Tunja. Where else do we have big Semana Santa celebrations? Of course, in Spain. But if you know of any other else out there and you want to share that information with us, let us know, because, of course, you know, we are blinded and tunnel vision towards Colombia here. So, I think it's in Santo Tomas, near to Barranquilla, where the people self-flagellate, walk around actually whipping themselves in the street. There's no procession per se, but it's very, so let's say, hardcore pilgrims doing, self-harm out there in the streets. Anyway, so that's one of the big things. You wouldn't find me doing that. No. So listen, I'd love to hear from you out there. This is, you can get in touch at columbiacalling@gmail.com, via the website, columbiacallingradio.com, and via Twitter at columbiacalling. And indeed, you can always check out what's going on through my own blog. That's richardmccall.com. So all my recent blogs are up there, and of course any articles that I've published in the mainstream press that have been put online will be up there as well, and links to this show, of course. So the most recent blog was, of course, the one about the a salute to the glory of the unpretentious eatery. We talk so much about how things are moving ahead and how Bogota's becoming so cosmopolitan, Colombia in general. But, sometimes it's necessary to have a hat tip to the stuff of old, the things that don't change. Maybe the prices increase, of course, over time, but the things that don't change, the quality, the service, the style, the smells, the ambience. And one of those was the 5001 restaurant there, the steakhouse, meat grillery, if you like, there on sort of like, I think it's Calle Carrera 13 and Marley, pretty much. So that was my most recent blog out there. Other stuff I've been writing, the article about Christopher Kavanagh, the Irish failed drug smuggler here, who's been here since 1986, if I'm not mistaken. That's coming out soon. I mean, we're just going through the final editorial process on that with my editor, and that will be out soon. Of course, I will put that up on the websites and Facebook and so on, so you can all read it. But in the meantime, you can turn over to the Bogota Post and read Mark Kennedy's review of the book, Mad Out of My Head, and that's the book about Christopher Kavanagh, written by Colin Post, reviewed by Mark Kennedy there, and it's on the BogotaPost.com. My most recent editorial is bound to ruffle a few feathers, the one there in the city paper, the citypaper, Bogota.com. It's about the fact of the peace dialogues and guerrillas going to jail, and they will. But we're going to talk about that later on in the show, because I've got a whole load of notes written down here about transitional justice and about the peace dialogues and what is going on. And so I think, you know, maybe it's time to talk a little bit more about that. But before that, we've got other issues to discuss. Impactingly, obviously, the way that the taxi driver unions are behaving in Bogota. But I will take a short break, and I'll be coming back to talk about that in the next segment of this show. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Don't go away. I'm back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota. And as I mentioned in the previous section, Nick, we would be talking about the taxi strike and the taxi issues here in Colombia and in Bogota. But before I get to that, on a personal note, so of the three books that I've been working on so far in 2015, although I have been working on them previous to 2015, two are in the finishing stages, I mean the very finishing stages, and the third one is coming to the end. So for those of you who listen to this show frequently or read my publications, you'll know. Was Gabo an Irishman, the book on which I am an editor with Caroline Doherty de Novoa and Victoria Kellaway, is in the final stages to be published. You know, we're really going through the final, you know, fine tooth comb right now, getting the last issues ironed out so that we can send it off to the printers. And so the editorial process is going very well. The artwork has been chosen. How do you like it? That cover that I've put up there on Facebook and on Tumblr and on Twitter and everything else. But how do you like it? I think it's a great cover. I'm very excited for this. And of course, it comes out for the book fair here in Bogota in May. And not only that, this year, due to Gabriel Garcia Marquez's demise last year, this year the guest of honor, let's say, is Aracataca, it's Macondo, it is Garcia Marquez, his writing is going to be the main theme. So we're going to piggyback on that and hopefully get a bit more publicity out of it and a bit more, let's say, interest in our collection. 26 essays contributed by writers from all over the world, Holland, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia. It's fantastic. It really is fantastic. So keep listening into the show. Keep looking out on Facebook because the links to the Amazon website, where you will be able to buy it, where you will be able to download it for your Kindle and in hard copy, they will be published here. Of course, I will be doing a strong, publicity drive for that book. The second book, of course, is The Brat Guide to Colombia. Now, I found myself, obviously, like always, I've done parts of the Viva Guide years ago, and then I did Fodor's chapter to Colombia years ago as well, and the Michelin Guide. And this time, there was asking, do you want to put editor's pick? Do you want to put, writer's choice and stuff? And I said, I have an ethical problem because, of course, I have friends, lots of friends in the hotel industry, restaurant industry, and so on. And, why would I not want to big up my own place? So I've decided to go against that, leaving people to choose the place, that best suits them, not what I think should be listed as the best. So that's a new sort of, pushing out the envelope there in guidebook writing. We're not going to have the book, these boxes that say, how to spend money or the best place to stay or anything like that. Travelers out there all check TripAdvisor. They're all checking other things. They're all talking to other travelers around and visitors and so on and so forth. So they can choose the best place for themselves. And that way we all come across fine and amicable and working for the same aim for Colombia. I think that's very important, that. And finally, the third book, I'm in the final stretch. I know I am. It's the Mompos Project, my own little project. I say little. We're now 20 chapters in, almost up to 65,000 words. I've started on an intro, Macondo, why Mompos, history, costeños, feudalism, ghostly tales, Doña Manuela, restorations, change, the presidential Mompos, paramilitary Mompos, guerrilla Mompos, staff, the Valenzuelas, guests, people, Russians, witchcraft, and then, of course, the ending. So it's pretty exciting. Pretty exciting to have all of that stuff. Anyway, so 65,000 words, almost done. I think in the next few weeks I will have it done, and then I'll be ready to print off my first draft to do an editing. And of course I am going through the long list of publishing houses out there to see if I can find a publisher for this book. So if there's anyone out there interested in this, perhaps, you know, it's going to be a gringo's take on contemporary Colombia put into perspective through the microcosm of Mompost. It's the, as they say, it's kind of like the belly button of Colombia. You can get everywhere from Mompox. It's just not as easy to get to. But it's not difficult. That's the great thing about it. So, moving swiftly on, yes, taxis, that's been our problem. That's been our problem. Now, that this has gone on and on. It's rolled on and on and on, this issue about the regular yellow taxi unions and Uber. All of you out there know what Uber is, you know, the sort of luxury private car service. If you're here in Bogota, you know all the cars are white, usually 4x4s, comfortable. The drivers are educated. They'll lend you their phone charger. They usually have water. They don't speed. They don't overtake on blind corners. They don't do any of the things that regular taxis do. And of course, they use GPSs. But the taxi union here has, well, you know, within their rights, complained about it. But what I feel is that their argument perhaps lacks credibility and legitimacy, because the first thing they always say to you is that, you know, they're stealing, Uber is stealing their work. Well, Uber only caters to a tiny percentage of Bogota North, let's say Colombian society. It's the top, top end. Who can afford to pay 25,000 pesos for a 5,000 peso taxi ride? You know, that's not for everyone. And then, of course, you can pay on your, because it's all online, it's all an app, you can pay on your credit card. Then they say they're piratas, you know, pirates, a piracy. These are false taxis. Now, okay, this is perhaps the most legitimate argument. Of course, they're not unionized and they're not on the level as in terms of taxis as we know it. But, you know, there is a need for more service in this city that has such a problem with public transport, with all these issues. Why can't we have a luxury service? What is the difference between taking an Uber taxi and the hotel's taxi? You know, they're waiting in those, you know, parking bays out front, you know, nice Mercedes taxi. And then they, you know, they say, well, you're not paying all the taxes, etc., etc. But, you know, we've all taken taxis here. We know about the Paseo Millonario. And the Paseo Millonario is a dreadful thing. The millionaire's ride, where you get picked up by, let's say, an unlicensed or pirate yellow cab, and someone jumps in alongside you, or they drug you with scopolamine, it's a burundanga, and then make you go to the your cash point, withdraw your money. And if you're Colombian, you end up on a trash heap somewhere. If you're a foreigner, well, some of you will remember the DEA agent Terry Watson a couple of years ago stabbed in a Paseo Millonario. There was more to that story than just a regular Paseo Millonario. But in any count, in any case, you know, we need a different service. Anyway, the Minister for Transport, the Vice Minister for Transport, Abello, I believe her name is, has caved completely. But I don't think she actually even put up any defence of Uber at all. I think she just went, yeah, that's it. I mean, there've been all sorts. And of course, we were on today, the 16th, we were supposed to have a taxi strike. And so they were going to probably block off the main roads and drive around the city at 5 kilometres an hour, so blocking the rest of the traffic and making life miserable for everyone else. Now, I did read and see some news reports earlier in the week, or last week, in fact, about, you know, some particularly militant taxi drivers blocking off the Autopista Norte, so the highway that heads out north towards the Stereo Picnic concert, the festival out there, and you know, they were forcibly making people get out of Uber or private cabs. I mean, forcibly making it. I mean, that you can't have this type of vigilante behaviour by taxi drivers. Now, the key one, I won't repeat his name, but he's been revealed. He even declared Bogota as a military objective. You know, we have to block Bogota. If we don't block Bogota, we don't block anything. So this man, he's an ex-military man, so of course that would make a sense for his language. Anyway, it so turns out that the owner of his car won't let him drive today, Monday the 16th, in case he does try and block roads and become more militant. But it's just, you know, where is the choice? Where is the choice for the long-suffering consumer here in Bogota? You know, I take taxis all the time, and it's unusual that I'm not complaining about something. Rounding up the money, going too fast, driving poorly, and not wanting to go where you want to go, etc., etc. The list goes on. I mean, the service is awful. And now they are untouchable. And now, you know, the Minister for Transport has said, no, that, you know, it's fine. So they're at the strongest point they could possibly be. This is not a good thing. Competition is a good thing. I don't see in the Ministerio TIC, Technology and Information Ministry, standing up to promote and protect apps. You know, this is entrepreneurial behavior, and yet, you know, Colombia is supposed to be a place for entrepreneurs and for the app revolution, and yet, as soon as something like this has come up, our freedom of choice has then been damaged and limited. And the Ministerio de TIC, you'd think they would be the ones who'd stand up and help us out in this one. But no, not at all. So what's going to be going on? Well, there's now no strike, fortunately. I mean, that's one thing. Otherwise, this Monday would have been awful. But there's a passenger strike. Those of us who are disgruntled, those of us who feel hard done by and underrepresented and with no voice and no choice in Bogota, on the 17th of March are doing the day of no taxis, where we all, you know, are we all committed to not taking taxis on the 17th of March. Spread the word, folks. Let's do it. Let's see if we can get people aligned in this one. I'm not some kind of militant, but I really feel that, you know, could we please send a message? Because taxis are full all the time. You try and get a taxi on a Friday afternoon in the rain here in Bogota, it's impossible. So you download the app, the Easy Taxi. They won't come and pick you up unless there's a tip, which actually is illegal, apparently, according to the law. They won't come and pick you up. If you put 1,000 pesos as a tip, they won't come. You put 5,000 pesos, and suddenly you've got four taxis heading, as you can see on your GPS, on the telephone, straight towards you. So the taxis are available, they just don't want to work. I find it very difficult to come to terms with the issue that, as consumers, we are being trampled upon once again. There's nothing protecting us whatsoever, and we've got such a lily-livered, spineless Secretary of Transport caving into the taxi drivers. Surely, yeah, actually, one more point to say about that is that this, the militant taxi driver, who's forcibly making people get that out of taxis and their Autopista Norte with like a Calle 200, was the one who said, oh yeah, you don't get Paseos Millonarios in Uber because you pay by credit card. No, you don't get Paseos Millonarios in Uber because they don't do Paseos Millonarios. You get them in the yellow taxis who aren't behaving right. So this is one of those scourges that looks set to, to continue. What is wrong with competition and what is wrong with freedom of choice? This is not something complicated. This is something that we need doing. And anyways, we'll be there thinking about that. The 17th of March, no taxi day. Spread the word. You can find a group on it. There's about 17,000 people joined up now. That's a good amount of people. If we have that kind of people backing it, we can actually make a difference. We can show the people that, you know, freedom is of choice is an important situation. We need to have an opportunity to make ourselves heard and to express our discontent with the way the city is being run and with the way that transport is being manipulated by these huge unions who are so strong and need to be broken. And so 17th of March, please, let's all get together and we will do the No Taxi Day, and that's how we can make ourselves heard, and that's how we can get you know, freedom of choice back. I'm Richard McCall. This is Columbia Calling. We're going to take a short break, and I will come back and leave the taxi issue alone, and we're going to be talking about transitional justice and the peace dialogues in Havana, Cuba, with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Don't go away. I'll be right back. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and without further ado, as I promised, we're going to talk about the peace talks. Yeah, so those are the peace talks between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, that's the FARC guerrillas to the you and I out there, but Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia and the Colombian government's negotiating team in Havana, Cuba. So they have the five-point agenda. Several of the points have been discussed. They've been going since November 2012. So we're into, you know, couple of years on now, but these things take time. Of course, we are impatient. That's our nature as human beings. We want peace to be signed, but this is the best, latest chance for some sort of open agreement with the FARC guerrillas. So let's put this into context with what's going on in Colombia at the moment, because if we talk about it, you know, okay, so on the 20th of December last year, the FARC guerrillas declared an indefinite ceasefire, against the military, etc. And this would only be broken if they came under direct attack. Well, you know, the conflict still continued. The government cannot commit. The government, not as I am, not the greatest fan of this government, but they cannot commit to not attacking or defending the civilian population. So then, of course, we have on the 12th of February, where the FARC declares that they will no longer recruit, children. They will no longer recruit members to their rank and file beneath the age of 17. Now, there aren't that many, supposedly, anymore around 15 or 16 years of age, but the top guys, you know, the top guys were guerrillas, and, you know, they had been recruited very young indeed. So it remains to be seen how this goes, but it's very interesting indeed. And if you want to talk about winning over the hearts and minds, they're not going to win. The FARC aren't going to win the hearts and minds of the people here in Colombia. We're talking since 1948, pretty much. 1964 is official date, but 1948, you know, we're talking about a conflict that's been going for over 50 years. The people are tired. The country is haggardly worn down by this conflict. So, you know, they're not going to win the hearts and minds, but they can win a little bit of trust. They can earn, let's say, a bit of trust, you know, by doing things that are more human of this nature. So, of course, we have to applaud that. And then on the 28th of February, so quite recently, we had the announcement, the joint announcement between the president and the FARC, that they would be working together in the demining of the country. So that's to get rid of landmines. Colombia is one of the most mined countries in the world. You know, the scourge. And of course, these aren't traditional landmines, you know, like the Italian, British made or anything like that, or Indonesian made. These are plastic bottles filled with explosives and detonated when you step on a syringe. You know, that's the sort of plunger detonator there. And of course, they're called the quiebra patas, the foot breakers, particularly unpleasant. And of course, much, much havoc around the country since they've been starting. Now, the FARC and the guerrilla groups, I did a lot of articles about this a couple of years ago, used to put mines in areas that were, of course, key to local communities and to, you know, it's to instill fear. So by water sources near to the trails leading out of these jungle towns and so on. So anything that comes together with a demining effort is good news, you know. So no more children maimed out playing in the fields on their football pitch. I've heard tales of, explosives being put inside footballs. So when kids kick them, they might explode. And of course, when I was in 1998, when I came here for the first time to travel up and down the Pacific coast, we wanted to give a football to a town, and of course the military said it wasn't permitted because it could be filled with explosives. I mean, that's sinister, if you ask me. So this is a good thing. So the FARC will be dressed as civilians. The fine details have not been ironed out yet, but the FARC will be dressed as civilians, and they will work alongside the military, you know, demining. So that, you know, these are the guys with the know-how, and they know, hopefully, where they place them all. So it's going to take up to 10 years to demine the whole of Colombia, but this is positive. You know, this has to happen. This is something that needs to go forwards. And this is for the good of Colombia. Now, most recently, the 10th of March, the government, President Santos, ordered his defense minister, Juan Carlos Pinzón, to cease bombing raids on FARC camps. Now, this is pretty phenomenal news, because it's not only is it and the next step in these peace dialogues, but it's a show of trust. You know, the FARC have given up, they've gone indefinite ceasefire, no more recruiting under 17, and now the demining effort. So this is the, you know, the response by the government. Of course, this has created all sorts of issues with the ultra right, the ultra conservatives saying no, you know, giving up, impunity, etc., etc. In fact, on Sunday there was a march in Medellin. I saw on I watched it on the internet though. Was it on Caracol? I think you can look it up. No, that's the FM. So that's lafam.com.co, about a march against the peace dialogues in Medellin. Fortunately, it wasn't, attended by thousands, if just hundreds of people. But equally, it shows that there is an, you know, there's an element out there who are not in agreement with the peace dialogues, but primarily because they're not getting the information, I believe. I mean, how can you march against peace if you know exactly what's at stake? But again, of course, it's a Colombian issue. It's a Colombian issue, and they've had the war for so long. You know, so, you know, I'm sticking my oar out here and meddling in things that, you know, I'm not a Colombian, but I've lived here on full time since 2007. You know, you've got a bit of an idea of what's going on. Now, at the base of this article about the Medellin march on Sunday, there's an opinion poll. And the opinion poll is like, do you agree or disagree with the cessation of the government's bombing raids on the FARC? Now, it's been voted on by 13,326 people. So, you know, a tiny amount. But 88.37% of that, so that's 11,776 votes, said that they are in disagreement. Only 10.94%, so almost 11%, 1,458 votes said they were in favour of the government ceasing the bombing raids. And of course, just 92 votes, that's 0.69%, didn't have an opinion. So it's quite serious. You know, you have to see. We don't know what demographic voted. We don't know who they were. I don't know if there were, you know, multiple people voting multiple times or anything like that, but just take an issue. It is curious. And if we think about, for example, there's been a great article, you know, and it's not often that I big up The Guardian, but an absolutely, well, The Observer, in fact, an excellent article by Ed Volumi, who, you know, on Sunday wrote a big piece in The Guardian Observer called Colombia: Is the End in Sight, the World's Longest War? Now, it is really a fantastic piece of writing, because it not only goes around the history, talking about 1948 and Gaitán's assassination and the difficulties. It's a big piece. I don't even know how big this would be in the broadsheet, but it's here. You know, we are 25 years now, more or less, since the M19 guerrilla groups, you know, became political, turned in their weapons, became political. Now, of course, they've got all sorts of different issues with which to argue about, because, of course, Pizarro, their leader, was assassinated by the paramilitaries, and various others have been assassinated by the paramilitaries. But we have now, you know, 2011, Gustavo Petro, a former M19 guerrilla, was elected into the Bogota. He was elected as the mayor of Bogota. So this is, you know, in a left-wing alliance called the Progresistas. This is, wherever your politics sit, this is a positive move that transitional justice does take place, that change can occur. There isn't really, you know, I mean, even left-wing people here aren't aren't amazingly left-wing, because we've been so afraid and so cowed by having, you know, if you're left-wing, you're a guerrilla. It's simple as that. So, you know, 25 years on, things are changing. I think as part of it is because, of course, of economic drivers, you know, internationalization and so on. But it's an interesting time. So we've been talking about, you know, these peace talks and the cessation of bombing. And, of course, the ultra-right, Ordóñez, our lovable, cuddly Attorney General, Alejandro Ordóñez, the first thing that he said was that this is akin to a bilateral ceasefire. Now, this is not true. It's the formalization of a certain amount of trust taking place between the FARC and the government. You know, the FARC get out there and they say, no prison for any guerrillas. But they're not saying these things for us. They're saying these things for impact. And this is what, you know, what you read in this very good article in The Observer by Ed Valumi. And, you know, it's not a bilateral ceasefire. It's not yet there. There are still conflicts. And, of course, it does seem like the government was paying a little bit of smoke and mirrors and that, a little bit of a, you know, sort of sinister, dastardly plot, because as soon as they announced this, they only went and killed, you know, one of the top, sort of, let's say, drug trafficking leaders of the FARC in the Cauca region. His name escapes me, but equally, he was killed that day. One of his top guys, really, really important for fundraising. You know, this is where a lot of the economic clout comes from. Of course, it's through the cocaine trade, and you know, the FARC themselves, the secretariat who are there in Havana, Cuba, you know, sucking on their big cigars and enjoying Havana Club and so on. You know, the first thing they said is, look at that, look at the duplicitous nature of the government, you know, announcing a cessation of bombing on our camps, but at the same time killing one of our top guys. And of course, it's all sort of leveled it out, but if, you know, the government has a role to play as well, and they need to play their role out to an audience of Colombians who are tired, they're weary, they've suffered. You know, Colombia's blood has been spilt over this last 5 decades. It really is quite a horrific contemporary history. Not to say that the, you know, previous history was any better, but so, you know, you have to think of these things. There's a lot more going on than exactly just a guerrilla, you know, Ivan Marquez or Pablo Catatumbo saying we won't spend a day in prison. They might not, but others will. Any one of those guys who can be connected to a massacre, a crime against humanity, displacement and disappearance, will come under trial for their crimes. So anyway, you know, while we have the March Against Peace in Medellin, a couple of weeks ago we had the March for Life, you know, sort of organized by Moscos there in Bogota. It was pretty well attended, you know. I mean, it was a Sunday. You're never going to get people out of there, you know, really out of their sitting chairs and off their bikes on a Sunday. But I find it hard that, you know, every time Santos, you know, for all of his faults, tries to push the process further ahead, and he's got farther than anyone else. I mean, you know, if we talk about the last one in Caguan, I mean, it was absolutely a farcical Pastrana's peace process in Caguan 2002 or 1998-2002. Anyway, so Santos is getting there. You know, we've got to support this. Surely not peace at any cost, but peace. It has to be an issue, and that people can march against it is quite worrying. But of course, we get the Attorney General, so Alejandro Ordóñez, standing up there and saying that this is a bilateral ceasefire. It's not yet. Military operations are still ongoing, just without the bombardments. And the bombardments have been the things that really, really have brought the FARC to their knees in recent years. You've got Raúl Reyes, who was famously killed within Ecuadorian territory, Mono Jojoy, Alfonso Cano, all of these guys are the Negro, what's this called, Acacia, Negro Acacia, all of these guys were brought down by bombing raids. But of course, you know, the FARC have evolved as well to evade the bombing raid. So, that, you know, you can play this off against one another. They're not stupid either. They know now how to avoid these bombing raids. They've got the information. They're continually aware because, you know, when as soon as any planes come over or whatever, you can hear it anyway. So, these are steps forward in a trust and in a confidence game. And, of course, beyond that, you know, we need to, not only the government needs to win the trust of the FARC needs to win the trust of the government, but also the public need to have a trust in both sides. And of course, the long-suffering Colombian people are not going to trust, you know, the government, in truth. I mean, you know, it was a very close-run election between Oscar Iván Zuluaga and Juan Manuel Santos. So you've got almost 50% of the country not completely in agreement. And then, of course, you've got people, you know, so you've got to get this sort of political equilibrium back. You want to get this legitimacy back. You can't have the Attorney General Alejandro Ordóñez at every opportunity lambasting the government for plans. And you can't have former president, now acting senator, Álvaro Uribe doing the same. These three guys need to sit down and chat it out, frankly. They need to be on board. They need to be talking together, because if Santos can get Uribe onto the bandwagon, that's winning over the rest of the country. So, you know, think about this. Think about this. Reflect on this. Now, these FARC announcements that they're not going to go and see any days in jail, these are announcements. These are press releases and sound bites that are directed at their own, at sympathizers to their groups. Why do I say that? Because the reality is different. They say these as part of the game. It's, you know, of course, it riles us. It would rile anyone. The FARC aren't going to see a day in jail. Of course, it's annoying. But the truth of the matter is, some of them are. And, you know, in very interesting, again, I'm referring back to this Guardian Observer article, you know, Sergio Jaramillo, perhaps the most intelligent, the most, you know, well-read, well-studied, etc., Oxford, Cambridge graduate, you know, Sergio Jaramillo said, you know, they are a lot less extreme in private than they are in public. So that gives you quite a lot of an idea about how they are manipulating the media, because of course they have worked this out. They are light years ahead in terms of social media and their cause than the government itself. You know, the military does not know how to manipulate social media and get their message across. And I was at a congress some years ago where, you know, the press officers from various sections of the military were there going, how do we do it? We've got a Twitter account, we've got an Instagram account, we've got this, we've got that, but we just can't get the message out, and they can't get the followers. But whereas the FARC, you know, can. It's very interesting. It's very a curious development. This is, you know, bringing conflict and verbal conflict into the 21st century. So very interesting topic to think about on that front. So, you know, when I wanted to talk about a bit more, though, this issue of transitional justice. Now, I studied this, you know, essentially this master's at the Javeriana University about conflict resolution, and one of the key things in it was, of course, we had one whole module called transitional justice. Now, this was taught by someone who actually works in the International Center, who worked in the International Center for Transitional Justice, Gustavo Salazar, you know, actually also involved in the Constitution of 91 and everything. But I want to read out, you know, what is transitional justice? Because it's a term that's getting bandied around. And if you don't really fully understand what it means, then, you know, a lot of what's going on is lost on you. So transitional justice refers to the set of judicial and non-judicial measures that have been implemented by different countries in order to redress the legacies of massive human rights abuses. These measures include criminal prosecutions, truth commissions, reparations programs, and various kinds of institutional reforms. Transitional justice is not a special kind of justice, but an approach to achieving justice in times of transition from conflict and or state repression. By trying to achieve accountability and redressing victims, transitional justice provides recognition of the rights of victims, promotes civic trust, and strengthens the democratic rule of law. So this is important. I mean, you know, you can already tell, and what I've been chatting about in this last 20-odd minutes is this very issue. So you think, in the aftermath of massive human rights abuses, victims have well-established rights to see the perpetrators punished, to know the truth, and to receive reparations. So, you know, what are the key elements of a comprehensive transitional justice policy? Well, they're not just parts of a random list, but are rather related to one another practically and conceptually. These core elements are criminal prosecutions, and I say this with, you know, as strong as possible, particularly those that address perpetrators considered to be the most responsible. If the international courts, if the Colombian courts can find, you know, can link these top guerrilla commanders to massacres, to human rights abuses, they will be tried. And likewise, so will the military. This is another issue that will come up. Secondly, reparations, through which governments recognize and take steps to address the harm suffered. Such initiatives have often have material elements such as cash payments or health services, as well as symbolic aspects such as public apologies or a day of remembrance. This can easily happen. Thirdly, institutional reform of abusive state institutions such as the armed forces, the police, and courts to dismantle by appropriate means the structural machinery of abuses and to prevent recurrence of serious human rights abuses and impunity. And fourthly, and finally, truth commissions or other means to investigate or and report on systematic patterns of abuse, recommend changes, and help understand the underlying causes of serious human rights violations. Haven't we discussed all of these things? Don't all of those topics actually have something to say? We know that the military are going to undergo a change. They've already started planning for a post-conflict. Look at what's going on with the demining. Look at the way that trust is being earned. Look at the way that things are now. What has to happen is that, you know, a different judicial system needs to be brought in where both the military, those guilty, of course, and the guerrillas will end up being tried in court, not in a military court, but in the civil courts about what has gone on in the last 50 years. Yes, it's going to unearth all sorts of issues. Look at what happened in Argentina when, I guess it was Menem, who pardoned everyone. Gone are the days of, you know, broad-ranging amnesties between groups. Colombia's issue will not be swept under the rug because so many people have been affected. What needs to happen here is people want to know the truth about what happened to their loved ones, what has happened to the country in all of these years. So there's going to be a very complete truth commission within Colombia. Amnesties no longer fly. And this is where Ivan Marquez, Pablo Catatumbo, Andres Paris, Tania Niemeyer, and all the rest of them are wrong when they say they will not spend, or no guerrillas will spend time in jail, because there will be some. It may not be immediately, it might just be happen a bit retroactively, because the Statute of Rome, signed by Colombia back in 2002, says, you know, back a few years ago, but it can be dated back to 2002, the Statute of Rome. So anything that's happened in that period of time, and things have happened. Yes, massacres have happened, disappearances have happened. So it might not take place immediately. Look what happened in Argentina. It took another sort of 20-odd years after the dirty war before aging generals were brought to justice. But it happened, and this enables a society to find an identity, to move forward. And I don't think that President Santos hasn't thought about this. There is a reason why Kofi Annan was here. There is a reason why people are talking about these things. It's because it's already being debated. So read the Ed Vuolumino piece in The Guardian, because it's excellent. I really do think so. I hope this has been informative for you. I hope to be able to come back to you next week and the week after with more interviews, maybe a bit lightweight after today, a bit more lightweight. But it is interesting, and we need, as expats or as Colombians indeed, we need to be observing and understanding what is going on. You know, there's too many phrases out there that may be technical, but we may not, but the crux of it is very basic at the end. It's about humanity. So hopefully we're moving towards the, you know, the right goal here in Colombia. We have to be positive. Surely that's the aim, isn't it? Anyway, please get in touch. You can get in touch through ColombiaCallingRadio@gmail.com, ColombiaCalling.com, and at Columbia Calling on Twitter. Of course, you can read my articles at RichardMcColl.com. I've enjoyed taking the time to talk you through this and transitional justice and the taxi issues and so on. Keep an eye out for my books, The Brat Guide to Colombia, and of course, Was Gabo an Irishman? And hopefully at some point in the future, I'll be able to get a publisher for The Mompos Project. So if you know of anyone, if you are an editor yourself or a publisher and you're interested, your curiosity has been piqued by my jabberings week in, week out, please get in touch. I'm very visible online. I've enjoyed today's show. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Columbia Calling. Please tune in next week. Thank you very much. Bye.